At one time, the Buddha was staying with his clan, the Shakyans, in Kapilavatthu, in the Banyan Park. And there was one of the Shakyan clan called Mahanama, who had just recovered from an illness, and he had heard how, now that the end of the rainy seasons were approaching, the monks were making robes for the Buddha, and they would shortly be setting out again on their wandering life once the rainy season had ended. And perhaps it was the Buddha's returning to a wandering, homeless life, in contrast to his own settled life, that sparked the question. But Mahanama asks the Buddha, "For those of us living by means of various dwelling places, by means of which dwelling place should we live?" So he's asking, what dwelling places should we live in? And by dwelling places here, he really means dwelling places of the mind. So he's asking of the Buddha an important question. Where should we dwell upon in our lives? What should we live by? What should we focus on? What should we dwell upon? What is the central focus of our lives? What should be at the center of our mandala? And not surprisingly, the Buddha responds by rousing him to practice the Dharma, to cultivate conviction, perseverance, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment. And once established in these qualities, he then says that Mahanama should develop 6 further recollections. Recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dharma, recollection of the Sangha, recollection of his own virtues, in other words, paying attention to his ethical practice, recollection of generosity, and recollection of the devas or the gods. And how I interpret this to mean is recollection of how skillful actions lead to future happiness. And the first 3 of these recollections, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, form the text of the Tirupavandana, the text that we're looking at this weekend. So just to remind you briefly of what these 3 recollections are recollecting, what these 3 jewels are. The Buddha represents enlightenment. He was, like you or I, a man. He lived over 2,500 years ago in India. And through his efforts, he gained enlightenment. He gained a state of freedom from limitation, freedom from suffering. And he represents the fact that there is this possibility for us, and that it is possible for any of us too to gain enlightenment. And how do we gain enlightenment? We practice the Dharma. We practice all those teachings which lead to the truth. So the Dharma is all those teachings, and the Dharma is that truth itself which we are aiming for. And we practice it with other people who are doing the same thing. We practice it with other Dharma practitioners. We practice it within the Sangha. So the Sangha can mean all those people down through the ages who have gained some measure of enlightenment themselves and whom we draw inspiration from. Or it can mean the inspiration that comes from a great feeling of the potential that arises within a Sangha, within a collection of us practicing together. And this is what it means to be a Buddhist. To have a sense that there is a state of freedom, there is a state of liberation possible, there is a means to achieve it, the Dharma, and there are others to draw inspiration from, to draw support upon in doing that. This is what we need to dwell upon in response to Mahanama's question. This is what we need to put at the center of our lives. This is what we need to go for refuge to. So this is what is focused on in the Tirupavandana. And as we heard last night, it is a core Tirupavandana text. It's regularly chanted by friends, mitras, order members all over our community. And large numbers of people chant it every morning, mainly as a way of orientating themselves towards that which is most important. And it's a very traditional text. Again, in its fullness, it comes from the Mahanama Sutta, but you get extracts from it again and again in the Pali Canon, particularly when there's one of the 3 jewels to be praised. And it's thanks to our founder, Bhante Sangharakshita, that it's such a central part of our liturgy, In his memoirs, you can read about Bhante performing puja, worship every morning in his various dwelling places in Kalimpong. And the Tirupavandana was usually one of the central texts, or the central text, that was part of his morning practice. So the text, the Tirupavandana, is an essential guide to what placing our heart upon the 3 jewels, to what going for refuge to the 3 jewels really involves. It's a clarification of what they are. It's a description of what these wonderfully shining jewels are and how brightly indeed they shine. And ideally, when we chant it with an unwavering confidence in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. But more likely for most of us, it's more that it gives expression to the aspirations that we have. It strengthens our convictions to go for refuge to the three jewels. To say a bit about the structure and the form, so obviously the first thing you notice is that it's in Pali, which is an ancient Buddhist language. Pali isn't quite what the Buddha would have spoken. There's no clear consensus, but it's reckoned that after the death of the Buddha, Pali evolved or emerged out of among Buddhists, out of the languages that were spoken by the disciples of the Buddha and the Buddha himself as a new language. But it's quite close to the Buddha's tongue, and we can take it as going right back to the Buddha in terms of its meaning and what it's trying to communicate. So many of you might have chanted it before, and perhaps this morning was the very first time for some of you as well. So just to say a bit about how it's structured, it's in three parts: the Buddha Vandana, the Dharma Vandana, and the Sangha Vandana. Vandana means salutation, and Tiratna is the three jewels. So usually the full title is Salutation to the Three Jewels. So today I'm going to be talking about the Buddha Vandana, and tomorrow morning Padmavajra will talk about the Dharma Vandana and the Sangha Vandana. So what I'd really like to do here today is to evoke the qualities of the Buddha mentioned and described in the Buddha Vandana, and to really give us a flavour of the Buddha that's being communicated in the Buddha Vandana. So it begins with some praises of the Buddha. Then there is a section describing or rejoicing in each jewel. This is the Tiratna Vandana as a whole now. And finally, there is a kind of a chorus of appreciation, aspiration, and devotion to each of the Buddhas, Dharmas, and Sanghas of the past, present, and future, along with an aspiration to go for refuge to them. Before we go into the Buddha Vandana, just one last note. Why should we look at the Tiratna Vandana? Why should we look at this text? Well, to begin with, it is a central text of Tiratna given to us by Sangharakshita from the earliest parts of Buddhism. And you might say, isn't it just a long piece of Pali that's hard to connect with? You know, isn't it just a memory exercise at times? And I think that's partially the reason why we wanted to put this on this weekend and explore it. We need, with the Tiratna Vandana, to get to know it well. We need to be able to breathe life into it. We need to understand the translation of the words. We need to connect with the meaning that's there in the text, so that when we do actually chant these words in Pali, we have a feeling for and an intelligence for what they are communicating. When we know what the words mean, it becomes less of a memory exercise and more of a sincere aspirational prayer, you could say. So, for example, that when you first done the refuges and precepts, they may mean very little to us beyond a nice and mysterious tune. But then as you chant them more and understand them more, you start to see that you're repeating a threefold aspiration to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then you're chanting the five precepts. And then we start to get a feel for the deeper significance of them. Well, in the same way, when we study the Tiratna Vandana, it really does repay the work that we put into it. I've been studying this for a while now in preparation for this weekend. And even just this morning, the Buddha Vandana was just so alive and rich and vivid, rather than just something you get through on the way to your meditation practice. Yeah. So we're going to go through it and explore what it's evoking. And in much of this, I'm drawing from Bhante's seminar on the Tiratna Vandana and a very good booklet by Subhuti, which is forthcoming. He'll be publishing it soon about the text as well. So let's just jump into the text then. So the Tiratna Vandana begins with a salutation to the Buddha, which is common to both the Tiratna Vandana and the refuges and precepts. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So we begin with Namo tassa. And this is a strong opening, which in a way sets the tone for the whole Vandana. Tassa means to him, and Namo, it's usually translated as salutations. So you could translate Namo Tassa simply as salutations to him. But I think Namo needs to be unpacked quite a bit, because it's the key to the whole text, really. You could even say Namo is a key to the whole of Buddhism. The word salutations is a bit weak, really, for what's been got at. So I want to spend a bit of time unpacking it. Namo really means bringing yourself down in front of, particularly in the sense of, or has the connotation of, bringing your head down to the ground in front of the feet of that which you revere. So there's a very strong element of devotion, of salutation in Namo that is continued right throughout the text, as we'll see. What Namo really is about is bringing yourself into a relationship with that which is beyond us, that which is higher than us. Implicit in Buddhism and explicit in Buddhism is the idea of spiritual hierarchy, that there are ways of being that are beyond us. There are ways of being that are far more developed than we are. We are not the pinnacle of creation. There are states of mind and ways of being that are far beyond what we are currently capable of accessing. And this is a very good thing when you think about it. When I think about the states of mind I get into, at times they are very exalted, at times they are very refined, at times they can be quite joyous, but a lot of the time I'm stuck and I'm sick of the same old repetitive states of mind. I'm stuck and I'm sick of the same old cravings, the same old stories, the same old reactions, which particularly kick in the instant life gets a little bit challenging or I don't get what I want. Increasingly, perhaps as I get a little older, I find myself sick of just how much low-level craving I do for pleasure, just to make things feel pleasant. And I'm quite sick as well of how I'm constantly trying to avoid pain. And as I practice more and more, I see just the depths to which that is almost hard-coded into my being. And perhaps most of all, I really get sick of the endless restlessness of the mind, how the mind is never satisfied. The mind is always reaching out. The mind is always hungry. And how deep feelings of peace are so fleeting. So it is a relief to know that there's something radically beyond the everyday mind. If this was all there was, that would be a grim picture indeed. So there is something that we can look up to and aspire to. And there is something beyond the endless cravings for pleasure and aversions for pain. Something beyond the innate restlessness of the mind. Something beyond the ever-seeking heart. So this is all there in Namo. This is what we need to come into relationship with, that we too, we can open up to something more than the everyday mind. And the really important thing is that we too can become like that which we aspire to. It's not just the Buddha out there and us here with nothing in between. We too can become more like the Buddha. We too can become like that which we revere. And if we don't have something to look beyond ourselves to, if we don't have something to revere, well, as the Buddha says in the Garbha Sutta, it is painful. It is unsatisfying. It is painful to live without honoring and respecting something or someone. If we don't have some ideal to look towards, if we don't have something beyond ourselves to look to, we are indeed impoverished. We are indeed lessened. So it might be worth discussing this in the groups. What do you revere? What do you look up to? And if you don't think you do revere or look up to, what will you do about that? So for all these reasons, Namo is the first word and the entire context of the Tirathnavandana. It's what we are evoking with the words, and it's the mental state that we're trying to get into with the words. So when we... it's the mental state with which we need to approach the words. My apologies. So Namo is what we are evoking with the words. We're trying to evoke this feeling of a relationship with something more. And also we need to come into the Tirathnavandana with that sense of reverence for something more. And I would say it's a very healthy sign, psychologically and spiritually speaking, that we can naturally revere, that we can naturally look up to something. I was in India last February at the Order Convention and at a meeting of the International Council, and the reverence shown quite naturally by our Indian brothers and sisters in our order and movement is quite remarkable. You could see it in Bodh Gaya. We'd all do puja together, hundreds of order members doing puja together under the Bodhi tree where the Buddha gained enlightenment. There was a wonderful feeling of worship and devotion. But there was a particular incident that really struck me when I was in Bajau Retreat Center, where we were for the International Council. We were celebrating Parinirvana Day, the celebration commemorating the physical death of the Buddha. And we were joined by the residential community living in Bajau Retreat Center, which is around seven men, mitras, and order members. And during the offering section of the puja, it was really remarkable just to see the men of that community make their offerings. They were so reverential in their offerings to the Buddha, but also to the picture of Bhante, the founder of Triratna, and Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar, the great Indian leader who led so many Indians to Buddhism to escape the hell of caste. So that was wonderful to see as well. But there was one particular young man who, after making his offering with great and intense devotion, walked down backwards from the shrine, always facing the Buddha. He walked down backwards with his head bowed and his hands folded, and all the way back very carefully, very mindfully, back down to his seat where he sat down again. And in India, it's a sign of reverence to not turn your back to someone, to always face them. And it was just done so naturally and so wonderfully and so expressively. I really got a sense of what a real experience of Namo is. And it wasn't done self-consciously. It wasn't done in a show-off way. It was just felt very, very natural, a very natural expression of his deep positive reverence for the Buddha. And it was a really beautiful thing to see. It was really something to inspire our devotion ourselves. So if you're not sure about this, I would say to try it out. If you don't easily access this already, I would really encourage you just to bow, just to prostrate to the Buddha, bow to something higher, and do it in an unself-conscious way. Do it in a not show-offy way. And often what I recommend to new people, if you haven't done much of this before, you can come into the shrine room when there's nobody here and try it out. So you can come in and do some discreet bows. You can come in and do a sneaky prostration if you want to try it out. If you're worried about falling flat on your face in the puja, you could practice beforehand. But I would really encourage you. Remember, the Buddha said that if we don't have anything we can bow to, we are impoverished. I remember after my first puja, after a retreat in Ireland many years ago, wandering around in the dark outside after the puja. And I remember seeing these huge, majestic, beautiful trees gently swaying in the night sky. And I just bowed to them. I just bowed to about five or six different trees. I was recklessly bowing to everything worthy of bowing to. And it just felt so wonderful and so healthy and so connecting. So it didn't feel in any way a diminishment of my being. In fact, it felt like an affirming of my relationship with the world around me. So we need to do this. And the Triratnavandana, we're not just bowing to majestic trees, we're bowing to the greatest possible ideal, which is the Buddha himself. And when we can do this right, it's simple, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. So all this is there at the start of the Triratnavandana, Namo Tassa, reverence to him. So who are we reverencing? He who is Bhagavato Arahato. And this is repeated in the next line, in the first line of the next section, Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho. So Itipiso means such indeed is he, or he is indeed. So the Buddha is indeed Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddho. So Bhagavato, or Bhagava, usually is translated as auspicious, lucky, fortunate, special, in a very positive sense, even blessed. It means someone who has a touch of magic to them, someone who has a certain glow. There's something wonderful about them that can't be pinned down. And you get a sense of this in the life of the Buddha, many times in fact. So just to pick one period of time, after the Buddha's enlightenment, his skin glowed brightly and he was quite striking. And this happened a few times actually in his life. And a little later after his enlightenment, he wanted to share the Dharma with someone. He wanted to go and spread the Dharma, not just keep it for himself. So he went looking for his five former companions in the spiritual life, the five ascetics. And these five ascetics had previously shunned him for eating food again after many years of harsh asceticism. And as they saw the Buddha walking towards them, they decided among themselves to ignore him and calling him a backslider. But when he arrived, there was something striking, something irresistible about the Buddha, something about him, something about his glow that they couldn't resist, and they all relented. and started talking to him and got back into communication with the Buddha. And what they could not resist here, I think, was this Bhagava quality of the Buddha. And we may experience this ourselves as well. So we walk into this wonderful shrine room. We have this wonderful statue of the Buddha in front of us. And it can have all kinds of effects on us. There can be something, we might not even like it initially. There might be something that it upsets in us or something like that. I have a friend who, when she first came into a shrine room, deliberately sat with her back to the Buddha because it was too strong for her. But it may have some kind of effect on us. And like the five ascetics, we may not be able to resist being drawn into a sense of something more. And like the five ascetics, we might find that this is to our great gain. So the ascetics, in getting it back in touch with the Buddha, all gained enlightenment after a period of time. So we might be brought somewhere deeply positive as well by being open to these Bhagava qualities. So Bhagava is a beautiful quality, and it is important to see the Buddha as beautiful. We have this really beautiful, strong figure here in the shrine, for example. Or if you think of what we would say emotionally of the Buddha, the deep love and kindness of the Buddha was very attractive and very beautiful to people. We are attracted to beauty. We want more of it. It draws us on. So we might see this tonight when we do the recollection of the Buddha as well. The Buddha is Bhagava. He is irresistible. The Buddha is also Arahang. He is Arahato. These are usually translated as worthy. So the Buddha had a very special kind of worth. In fact, he had the only real lasting worth, which is prajna, which is spiritual insight. And I think this is shown in another instant after his enlightenment, where he was asked by a Brahmin, a holy person, what makes one a Brahmin? And the Buddha replied that it is not being born into a certain family, but rather your inner morality, your spiritual purity. And again in India, there is a place where this is very striking. As you enter the Mahabodhi temple complex, the place where the Buddha gained enlightenment, there is a place, there is an old pillar commemorating this incident where this happened, apparently under a banyan tree, Ajapala Nigrodha. And the Buddha responded to the Brahmana saying, by one's deeds one becomes a Brahmana, not by birth. Or it's put more succinctly, worth, not birth, that measures a man. And this was one of my favorite spots in the temple complex, because the more you see of the situation in India, the more you realize just how much suffering is caused by the caste system, where your worth is measured by your birth, not by what you do. And I was particularly moved by seeing our Indian brothers and sisters walking past this sign and touching it reverentially or bowing their head to it. So it is a very important message, this. It is worth, not birth. And the Buddha is worthy. His worth comes from an inner spiritual purity, his inner perfection, his prajna. As well as that then, the Buddha is Samma Sambuddho, or Samma Sambuddhasa. So Buddho, or Buddha, is usually translated as awakened one. But the root meaning is actually related to intellect, or understanding, or knowledge. A Buddha is someone who understands in the deepest sense of understanding the true nature of things. And then Samma is an emphatic, an emphasizer. It means wholeness, completeness, fullness. So the Buddha is not just someone who understands the true nature of things, who has transcendental insight. He has it to the fullest possible degree possible. He was very clear with his enlightened disciples, your understanding is the same as my understanding. But at the same time, he did it first, in a particular place and time, having worked traditionally for lifetimes to gain the necessary powers, strengths, skills, and merits to do so. And it's a remarkable achievement, and you do get the feeling from looking at the Pali Canon that the Buddha was revered deeply, even by his enlightened disciples. He definitely was something beyond them. He was something Samma, something beyond even their achievement. So he's a Samma Sambuddha. So all of this is there in this first section. The Buddha is someone wonderful, remarkable, who is free, who has gained what is truly worthy, who is completely and totally wise, who has gained that wisdom by himself, and has all the powers necessary to reignite the Dharma in the world. So when we say Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddha, Sambuddhasa, we are saying that we are getting into, we're going to bow at the feet of that which is highest. We are recognizing that we are not enlightened, but we are getting into a relationship with that which we aspire to be. We are fully respecting ourselves and at the same time recognizing our limitations and having a vision of what we'd like to grow into. And we can rejoice that there is something supremely positive which is beyond us, but which we can actually become. So next in the Chiratnavantana, there's a list of qualities of the Buddha. So firstly, he's Vicha Charana Sampanno, which is usually translated as equipped with knowledge and practice. So Vijja, or Vidya in Sanskrit, is knowledge, not merely in the sense of the true nature of things, but knowing how the Dharma, knowing what Dharma practice is and how the Dharma in particular is applied in the world. And Charana is conduct. So the Buddha not only knows the Dharma, he knows how it works, he knows how to apply it, he knows the conduct that goes along with it. And this perhaps echoes one of Bhante's famous aphorisms. The central problem of the spiritual life is finding emotional equivalence to our intellectual understandings. The central problem of our spiritual life is finding emotional equivalence to our intellectual understandings. So we need not only to be clear about the Dharma, we need to know how to apply it as well in our lives. We need to act in accordance with it. We need to look at our conduct. We need to bring the Dharma from our heads down into our hearts, or even into our guts, which is usually where we act from. We need to walk the talk, you might say. And the Buddha knew how to do this. He showed again and again in these interactions with people, not just that he knew the Dharma, but he knew how to apply it to their lives, how to help them to gain freedom. The classic example for me is the story of Kisagotami. So Kisagotami was a woman whose child had died, and she was sent to the Buddha by people because she was crazed with grief and refused to believe that the child was dead. And she went to the Buddha asking for medicine to cure her child. And the Buddha told her to find a mustard seed, that he could make medicine from a mustard seed from a house where nobody had died. And so she went from house to house asking for a mustard seed, which was very easy to give, but it had to be from a house where nobody had died. And again she received the same refrain. The living are few, the dead are many. And there was no house where nobody had died in. And through this reflection on death, in a way, she came to realize what had happened. And she let go of her child and became a follower of the Buddha and later gained enlightenment. So the Buddha knew the theoretical knowledge of impermanence and change and death, but he also knew superbly how to apply it in a way that she could actually take on. He also had the conduct which comes from his insight. So another example from the Pali Canon is that he once visited a sangha of monks and came across a monk with dysentery. He was going from hut to hut, from hermitage to hermitage, and he found in one little hut an old monk lying in a terrible condition, lying in his own filth. He had been left there for a number of days by the other monks. Apparently this monk had quite a vicious tongue on him. He was very sharp tongue. And so they had thought that he was of no use to them, and they had left him there. So the Buddha and Ananda cared for him, washed him, put him to bed, and made him comfortable. And then he called the monks together and he said, "Monks, you have neither father nor mother, nor brother nor sister. You have given up the world. You must be brother and sister. You must be mother and father to one another. He who wishes to serve me, let him serve the sick." So the Buddha naturally knows the conduct as well that goes with being enlightened. He naturally acts that way. He's equipped with knowledge and practice, as the translation goes. The Buddha is also Sugato. So Su is a prefix which means well, happy, good, wonderful. And Gato means going or gone to. So the Buddha is happily going, happily proceeding. You could say it means that the Buddha is one who has gone to or achieved happiness. And this comes back to his freedom and his insight. Being a Buddha completes and fulfills you. By contrast, we're probably all too keenly aware of that inner gap that we have, that space inside us that is so hard to fill. that restlessness that we don't want to engage with. We probably have all felt incomplete at times. Well, the only solution to that incompleteness, brothers, is to become a Buddha, I'm afraid. What we're really craving for is to become a Sama Sambuddha ourselves. What we really desire is to be Sugato, to be happily gone to enlightenment like the Buddha has. The Buddha embodies the only real and lasting way out of the suffering of the incompleteness of the human condition. There is no other solution that works according to him. So he is Sugato, he is happily gone. The Buddha is also Lokavidu. So Loka is a world or a realm. So for example, we're here this weekend in Padmaloka, the realm of the lotus. And in the Tiratmavandana, Loka means the entire world, the entire universe. So Vidu means knowing or seeing. So the Buddha is he who knows or sees the worlds, he who knows or sees all the worlds, all the universe. So does this mean that the Buddha is omniscient? Does he know what's going on everywhere? It's not in the literal sense the case that the Buddha is omniscient. He never claimed to be omniscient. But rather, he does fully know that which sees everything, that with which we see everything. So he fully knows and understands the human mind. It is the mind that sees. It is the mind that takes in our whole world. In the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw but five skandhas, the five components of what make up our experience, of what make up our mind, and there was nothing else beyond those. So there is only the mind. We have only the mind to see the world. We can only see the mind. We can only experience the world. We can only see the world through the mind. And not just that, but we actively create our world with our minds to a degree that we probably don't really fathom. As the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, produced by mind. So the Buddha understands the fundamental character and nature of all the worlds we experience because he fully understands the mind with which we have this experience. It's not that he has seen every possible world literally, but because he knows the fundamental nature of things and how the mind works, he sees any experience that we could have. So we need to take this on as well. Whatever our experience is, whatever mind we have at this moment in time, we can apply the Dharma to it. We can understand it like the Buddha understands it. We can work with it. We can try and understand it more fully. I think one of the mistakes people make often in the Dharma life is that we think we have to get our difficulties out of the way before we can practice the Dharma wholeheartedly. For example, when we're on retreat, we can think, oh, I just feel so grumpy, or so tired, or so bored, or so annoyed. I wish I could get over that so I could practice the Dharma. And I know it sounds a bit silly when we put it like that, but that is actually our experience a lot of the time. At least it's certainly my experience. But these challenges are the Dharma. These are what we need to be taking the Dharmic perspective on. We need to work with our minds in these situations. We need to work with whatever mind-created world we find ourselves in. We can't just look for the positive worlds where there is no discomfort and put our Dharma life on hold until we achieve them. So if we want to become like the Buddha, we need to take on this perspective. We need to see things. We need to see the world we're in right now in the light of his teachings, particularly in terms of change, arising and passing, craving and suffering, contentment and generosity, and so on. If we're making excuses, we're not really fully taking responsibility for our Dharma lives. We're not doing it right. We're not really working to become a Loka Vidu, a knower of the worlds, a knower of the various worlds we get into, and the mind with which we get into it with. And then the Buddha is also Anuttaro, supreme, without anything higher. It's not that the Buddha is God or that there is a God whom the Buddha is beyond, but that the Buddha has attained that which is the highest attainment, the highest thing possible to attain. So as we go for refuge to the Buddha, we are confident that he is supreme, and we understand in what sense we mean this. He is Purusa Dhamma Sarati. So Purusa means, well, we can translate it as humanity or human beings, and Dhamma, D-A-M-M-A, means capable and requiring training. So Purusadama means all those who are capable of training, but in particular all those who want training, who are desirous of training. And Sarati is literally the one who controls animals, or a tamer. So we are animals to be tamed, according to the Buddha. So the Buddha is one who is capable of training all those who need to be trained, who wish to be trained, taming all those who wish to be tamed. If you are not willing to be trained, then the Buddha cannot do much for you. As he famously said, he merely points out the way. By us must the effort be made. And perhaps paradoxically, the first effort we need to make is to be receptive and open to the teachings, be receptive and open to the Buddha, be receptive and open to the one communicating the training. So it might be worth discussing in your groups if you think of the Dharma as a training. Is it something that you take on as a training? Is it something that you take on even as a discipline? Are we open to that training changing us? Are we prepared to be inconvenienced by the Dharma? That is what it means to be trained. We need to be ready to be inconvenienced by it. We need to make changes according to it. Traditionally, what we call Buddhism was referred to the Buddha as the Dharma Vinaya, the doctrine and the discipline. So it's a set of teachings, but it's also a discipline. It's also a training. And if we don't see the Dharma as a training, as a discipline to take on, even at inconvenience at times ourselves, then we're missing out on something. We're missing out on a vital part of what we're trying to do in the Dharma life. This word training might evoke a response to us. Taming, do we want to be tamed? Do we want to feel tame? For many people, it's probably a bit of a distasteful or pejorative word. Maybe it's due to religious conditioning, who knows. But in this case, taming people is a question of being able to help people really understand their natures. When the Buddha tames men, he really means he works with them to help bring them on, to draw out the best in them, to help them understand themselves. So this is what is truly meant here. The Buddha is an extremely skilled trainer of human beings. He isn't wise in the abstract. He knows how the Dharma is applied to us and to our minds. He teaches suffering and the end of suffering. He's interested in the practical nature of that. And he can do this anywhere. Anywhere there is self-awareness, anywhere there is a self, there will be suffering, and there will be a path beyond suffering, which is the Dharma of the Buddha. The Buddha then is also Satta Deva Manusanan. So he's a teacher, a Satta, of gods and men, Deva Manusanan. Traditionally, the Buddha would teach by day to his disciples and then be visited at night by devas, by gods and goddesses. And for example, in the Rohitasa Sutta, the Buddha is visited in the dead of night by a deva, Rohitasa, whose splendor and beauty lights up the whole grove that the Buddha is staying in, and he receives a teaching from the Buddha. So we can take it quite literally that the Buddha was a teacher of gods and men. Perhaps another way we can take it is that he's the teacher of all conscious beings. He has disciples at all levels of human experience. But I think we need to read a little bit more into this, actually. The Buddha is in contact with other dimensions of reality beyond the everyday. He is able to interact and communicate with beings in dreams, in visionary dimensions. And at the very least, we need to see the Buddha who has gone far beyond ordinary human consciousness. And how can we know what levels of consciousness the Buddha is in touch with? The Buddha is not merely just a good bloke who's quite good at things. He is in constant connection with something that is far beyond anything that we currently imagine. How can we know the mysteries of higher levels of consciousness? We may from time to time in meditation or visionary experience have a taste of what these higher states of consciousness can be. But really, it's so far beyond us so much of the time. And we have to be very wary of the tendency of the unenlightened mind to pull these higher states of mind down to our everyday levels of talking about it. A thought experiment sometimes I think of is, imagine a cow out in a field eating its grass. There's many cows out there. You can try this later on if you want. But imagine someone going up to the cow and saying somehow to it, listen, there's this incredible thing called self-awareness. You don't have to respond to the world purely on instinct and unawareness. We can be self-aware, and it's amazing. And the cow says somehow, nah, I'm not interested. I just want to stay here in my animal instinct and just eat grass all day long. So the Buddha is coming up and whispering in our ear that there is this radical dimension of mind far beyond the everyday of our experience. And he is permanently in touch with that and trying to point it out to us all the time. So will we rather just stay in our field eating our grass, or will we try and be open to that greater horizon that the Buddha is offering? And this is another reason why we need to keep the Buddha as a living figure in our lives. We need to keep evoking him through practices like the Tirathavandana, because the tendency is always to go back and just go back to our field and eat our grass again. We need to have some kind of sense of the higher. We need to have some kind of truly transcendental presence in our life. We need to have some symbol pointing beyond itself, to wisdom, to something decisively beyond the self. So the Buddha is the teacher of gods and men. And no matter what dimension the Buddha is in, he applies and teaches the Dharma there. No matter what realm of consciousness the Buddha is in, he knows it and is ready to teach people. And then this verse ends with Buddho Bhagavati, which simply means, such indeed is he. So then the last verse of the Buddha Vandana, it's similar in each of the three Vandanas. It's kind of almost like a chorus. So it begins with the line, Buddhang Jivita Paryantang Saranangachami. And this translates as, whatever the span of life I have, I go for refuge to the Buddha. So long as I live, so long as I draw breath, I go for refuge to the Buddha. I put the Buddha at the center of my life. The Buddha is the central lodestone of my life. And it's not just the historical Buddha that we're talking about here. It's the Buddha of all times, wherever we find them. Yeche Buddha Atitacha, all the Buddhas of the past. Yeche Buddha Anagata, to all the Buddhas of the present. Pachupana Cheye Buddha, all those Buddhas yet to be in the future. Ahang Vandami Sabada, I bow down to them all. My worship flows unceasingly. So here we're not only bowing to the historical Buddha, but we are entering into a relationship with Buddhahood as a universal and ever-recurring phenomena. Buddhahood arises again and again wherever there is self-awareness, wherever there is consciousness and the right conditions. Traditionally, it's said that even though the Buddha is the supreme being, the highest attainment possible, he is not historically unique. And there have been a number of Buddhas, traditionally, on this planet, each of whom has rediscovered and taught the Dharma. And the Mahayana takes this even further with Buddhas all over the universe, discovering and rediscovering the Dharma. So you can take that whatever way you will, but I think what has really been communicated is that Buddhahood is possible in any time and is not just a unique occurrence, even though it is of highest importance. So I think what's really been got at here is that we really need to enter into a new relationship with the universe, with how things fundamentally are. We need to enter into a relationship with a living universe. Bhante emphasizes the need for this way of seeing the universe very strongly in his amazing book, A Survey of Buddhism. He quotes his good friend Lama Govinda, which I'll repeat here now, about the ever-recurring nature of Buddhahood in the universe. So this is Lama Govinda. The universal background of recurring Buddhahood reveals one of the most profound ideas of Buddhism, which raises its teaching above the narrow concepts of dogmatic sectarianism, namely the inescapable conclusion that the quality of enlightenment is inherent in the universe, or more correctly, latent in every form of consciousness, and therefore must come to maturity wherever the conditions are favorable. And he goes on to say, thus, the human life of a Buddha must be seen in an entirely different perspective. It becomes a mere fraction of a far bigger and more important development, in which the human element is simply and essentially the vehicle for the rediscovery of the universal and transcendental character of mind and consciousness. So in other words, human life is to be seen from a much greater perspective, a perspective for all human development, is essentially the vehicle for the rediscovery of Buddhahood. This is what the transcendental principle, this is what we call the transcendental principle. It's this principle in the universe that enlightenment is fundamental to the universe. It's the most important thing we can do, especially seen in the context of all experience possible. In the Garbha Sutta, the Buddha, shortly after his enlightenment, realizes that it is painful not to revere someone, not to look up to something. But he realizes that there is no one person that he can look up to, no one who is attained as he is. So he decides to revere the Dharma. He decides to dwell in dependence upon the Dharma, honoring and respecting the Dharma. Bhante last year wrote quite an important short piece called Some Reflections on the Garbha Sutta, where he is musing upon this incident. And he asks, what is this Dharma that the Buddha decides to revere and dwell in reverence upon? And it is not his teachings, because at this point the Buddha hasn't given any teachings. So to quote Bhante about this, he says, to my mind, the Buddha is speaking about what it is that makes a Buddha, whatever that may be. In other words, he is implying that we live in a universe of such a nature that, provided certain moral and spiritual conditions have been met, it is possible for a human being to attain Buddhahood. What the Buddha is doing here is giving us an example at the very highest level of what one should live like. Like other Buddhists, members of the Triratna Buddhist order should look up. We should look up to the Buddha, to our spiritual teachers, and to all those who are truly great. So this is what has been got at with the Buddhas of the three times, of the future, the past, and the present. We revere not just the Buddha, but that we live in a universe in which enlightenment is a living possibility at all times. We live in a universe in which enlightenment will recur again and again as the culmination of all life. We live in a universe where enlightenment is the highest aspiration of life, and where the universe is, poetically speaking, fundamentally orientated towards that happening. So in this context, the final few lines of the Buddha Vandana make complete sense. Nati me saranang anyang, there can be no other refuge for me. When we see life in this way, all other refuges drop away and we see through their impoverished nature compared to the Buddha. Buddho me saranang varang, the Buddha for me is the supreme refuge. He is the only refuge I need. He is the best refuge in the universe, the highest we can aim for. Etena satcha vachena, oh, by the virtue of this truth, this satcha, hotu me jaya mangalam. So jaya is victory, and mangalam means luck or auspiciousness or good fortune. So Bhante translates this as, may grace abound in victory. So by this truth about the nature of life, may all victory and all good fortune flow everywhere. So this comes from the virtue of the truth. Truth is power. As Bhante says somewhere, find the truth and then live by it. Find the truth and then live by it. If you affirm the truth, if you live by it, wonderful things will happen. The world shakes and it brings victory. And it is a victory for ourselves and for all beings. And great fortune will abound everywhere. So to move towards finishing, this is the vision presented to us by the Buddha Vandana. This is who the Buddha is. This is who is represented here in this beautiful shrine made by Alaka. It's a vision of the Buddha which is quite remarkable. It's a wonderful perspective which goes beyond the dour materialism and consumerism which is on offer today by contrast. So what would it be like to live in devotion to life itself in this way, to see the magnificence of human potential and the arising of Buddhahood? Perhaps the closest I've come to this experience myself is again on that trip in India. So near the end of my trip, I was lucky enough to travel for a few days with Jnanadara and Paramabandhu, and we visited the caves of Ajanta and Ellora in Maharashtra. And the caves of Ajanta are an old monastery system, valley, river curve in the valley. And it's a mix of caves which are temples and caves which are small contained monasteries. And they're truly amazing places. I'd really encourage you to visit Ajanta and Ellora as part of a visit to our brothers in India as well. And Ajanta has beautiful frescoes on the walls and statues and carvings. And sadly, the frescoes are fading now due to water damage. But you can still see them, and they're intensely devotional and beautiful. Many of you will actually know one of the more famous images, which is used on the front of Sangharakshita's book, The Bodhisattva Ideal, which is an image of Padmapani. And I got to see it in person, and that was quite an experience. And then Ellora is another cave system a little bit away. It doesn't have frescoes, but it has many beautiful statues and caves as well. And what really struck me the most from all these frescoes and statues is the beauty of the faces, the beauty of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas depicted. Particularly in the Bodhisattvas and Buddha, in the Bodhisattvas, there's a transcendent joy which shines through their faces. It is incredibly bright and beautiful and inspiring. Particularly in Ellora, actually, where down the road you can see some Hindu and Jain temples, and they just lack the same kind of quality, it must be said. So in these Bodhisattva figures, you get a sense from them of the depth of refinement and positive emotion in the enlightened states of mind. They really are truly beautiful. And in the monasteries, in many of the monasteries, you get this enormous Buddha in a Gandakuti, a perfumed chamber at the centre. And these Buddhas are immense and strong and powerful and still and solid figures. None of the limp affectedness that you get in some modern Buddhist representations. They're almost unnervingly powerful. There's something sacred about them. There's something transcendent about them. They're an embodiment of all the characteristics that I've talked about today in the Buddhavandana. And there are many beautiful images. Two that really struck me as well was there's a beautiful image of the Buddha being attacked by Mara. The Buddha with all of Mara's legions around him, shooting at him and trying to distract him. And in this case, the Buddha sits very calmly and beautifully in the centre with his hand in the generosity mudra, which is unusual for that incident. But it's a very beautiful piece. And there's also a very, very beautiful Buddha in his Parinirvana posture, where he's lying just before his death, completely undisturbed in the face of death, surrounded by his arahants and disciples in various states of response. And some of the places, some of the caves you go into, they're only half finished, and you get a sense of just how much work has gone into these caves. They were carved out by hand. And the smallest cave system would be maybe twice, three times the size of this room. And it was carved out of solid rock by hand. And it really was a work of generations of devotion. And it's important to say that, it's important to remind you that the end goal of this work was not to have a nice art gallery or visitor centre. It was actually a living monastery. It was done out of devotion, an act of giving to a higher goal, an act of getting into relationship with the goal of life. And in these frescoes and in these depictions, all of life was there, from people to animals to devas, from commerce to family life to politics. And what is really communicated in them is a world radically rooted in and centered around the Buddha. Now, obviously, they're not used nowadays as living monasteries like they used to, but the old Buddhas still sit there, dignified and beautiful. The beautiful, calm and radiant attendant bodhisattvas still stand there either side of them, communicating a radiant inner peace and joy. And in Ellora, for example, we found a quieter part of the complex, a smaller temple and shrine, and we meditated there a number of times. And it was really beautiful sitting there. You didn't have to meditate. You just sat there and soaked it all up. You were in tune with the radiant peace and joy of the bodhisattvas. You're in tune with the stillness of the massive Buddhas. And you got a sense of what it would be like to have this inner restlessness that affects us so much. You have a sense of what it would be like for that to be stilled. And I remember being struck very strongly as we chanted the Tiratnavandana there, that in that context, the Buddha Vandana makes complete sense. Of course you would want to sit at the feet of the Buddha. Of course you want to pay your reverence to the Buddha. Of course this is the highest vision possible for my life. Of course this is what I want to give myself to. So this is what we're trying to evoke. This is what we are evoking with the Buddha Vandana. This is the context within which we should aspire to connect with it. And when we chant, this is what we're trying to connect with when we're chanting it. We're trying to connect with this amazing figure of the Buddha and the transcendental principle that he represents. And we're trying to connect with and be open to a universe, our universe, radically orientated around enlightenment. So, oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. Thank you.